The Onish Pasha's Yikro.
So Hashem, I'd like to speak today about Heta Iska. I'd like to explain how it works. And Hashem, when we know how it works, then we ought to understand when we can use a Heta Iska, when sometimes it may need adjusting, and when sometimes it may not work at all. Anyone who learns through the sugyas and the halachas of Hilchos Yubis may be quite surprised to find that Heta Iska doesn't appear anywhere. Not in the Gemara, not Rishonim, not Shulchan Aruch, not Ramah, it doesn't appear anywhere. The simple reason is because it was only established just after the tkufa of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramon. It was established during the tkufa of the Sma, the Levush, and the Bach. The Gdolei HaPoskim of the time, or the Vad of the Arba Arotzos, they're the ones who established this idea of a Heta Iska. The reason they established it was, as the Sma writes, was Losis Micho Levnei Bris, to provide Parnassah for Bnei Bris, for the Yidden. It seems at the time it was difficult for Yidden to find Parnassah. One of the popular choices for Parnassah was money lending. For Yid, this posed a problem. A Yid can't lend another Yid Beribis. So the Vada, the Dalga Arotzos, they came up with the idea of a Heta Iska. Mendel ben Rabbi Victor, he was the Abbezin of Ludmi at the time, later the Abbezin of Krakow, and he was the one who drafted the first Nusuch of the Heta Iska. And his nusuch more or less became the standard nusuch of Heta Iska, which we have nowadays as well. It was a slight adjustment of the Chochmas Sodom. Before we discuss what a Heta Iska is, I'd just like to clarify what a Heta Iska is not. A Heta Iska is not a shtar which allows a Yid to lend another Yid Beribis. To actually lend another Yid Beribis is practically no Aterim, because all this Amon Shulchan Aruch, come out no Aterim to...
Please speak a little bit slower, it's difficult
to catch. There are practically no Aterim in the Shulchan Aruch to actually lend money Beribis. So what is a Heta Iska? So before we go into detail, the basic outline of a Heta Iska is that the Poskim, when they first introduced the Heta Iska, they introduced it for situations where a borrower wanted to borrow money from a lender, and he wanted it specifically for investment purposes, either to invest or for his business, or specifically for investing. So the idea of the Heta Iska was to restructure what normally would have been a loan. They restructured it that the loan shouldn't be a loan, it should be an investment. In other words, instead of the lender giving the borrower a regular loan and charging interest on it, instead he gives the money to the borrower as capital, and for the borrower to now invest in his business, and the lender will be a partner in his business. Now the lender is a partner in the business, the borrower can give a share of the profits of the investment to the lender. Obviously, this is not so straightforward.
If there's no profits,
then
or a loss, then
we have a problem. So that's the obvious question. A lender, that's not what a lender is trying to do. An investment, by definition, has risks. If the investment is successful, then the investor can get a return, his capital plus profits. And if not, then he can't get it. So how does a Heta Iska achieve that the lender can make an investment and be sure that he's going to get his capital back with profits? So let's make a start. The Heta Iska is made up of five main parts. We'll list them, and then we'll go through them one by one. Five main parts are, firstly, is number one is to restructure the loan into an investment. Number two is we have to pay the borrower who's going to invest the money. He's not investing it for free, he's going to have to be paid for his work. This is called Schat Ircha. We'll see what, soon why he has to be paid. Stage number three is we try and guarantee the lender his capital as much as we can. Stage number four is we try and guarantee the investor, the lender, also a profit. They should be able to get a fixed profit. And number five is we set the schumus bashus, the lender's rate of return of the profit that he wants to make. We have to set how much can the lender set for his rate of return. So stage number one. as we just explained, that the stage number one is we restructure the loan into an investment. The lender and the borrower have now agreed to restructure the loan. It's no longer a loan, it's an investment. So what kind of investment do we mean? When we say investment, what does an investment mean? So in the Chazal we find two kinds of investments which we use in Heta Iska. There's an investment of a Kulav Bekodin, an investment of a Chatzimu of a Chatzim Bekodin. A Kulav Bekodin investment is a very common investment nowadays as well. This is where an investor gives capital to an investing agent, investment management, and he tells him, I'm giving you capital, for £100,000, I'm giving you this capital to invest. The investment I want it to be entirely mine, should be my investment. I'll receive all profits and I will have to bear all losses. You, as an agent, I'll pay you a fee for your work and you do the work of finding the investment, managing the investment, and that's your side. But otherwise, the investment is entirely mine. It's called Picardin, just like a Picardin. The Picardin, when somebody gives somebody a deposit, the Picardin belongs to the owner, remains the property of the owner. So too with this investment, the investor gives the money to the agent, the money remains his, and anything that the money buys belongs to the investor. That's why it's called Kulav Bekodin. Chatzim of a Chatzim Bekodin is very different. Although it's the same that the investor, he's the one that provides the entire capital, but when he provides the capital, he's creating a partnership. He tells the lender, the investor, tells the agent, I'm giving you £100,000, half of the 100,000, 50,000 of it, I'm giving for myself, I want you to buy for me an investment, and that half should be my share of the investment, and I'll be entitled to all the profits of that half, and after all losses of that half, and the other 50,000 I'm giving to you, for you to borrow, for you to buy the other half of the investment, and being your share of the investment, you're entitled to half the profits, and you have to bear the losses of that half as well. So now he's created a partnership, they're both joint owners of this investment, 50,000 the investors, 50,000 is the agents, and they each one they get the profits of each one of their own half. The advantage of using a Kulav Bekodin investment for a regular investor is that if there's profits, then he's entitled to all the profits. The downside, the disadvantage is that if there's losses, he has to suffer all the losses. The advantage of a Chatzim Milva, Chatzim Bekodin is more for a low risk investor. If he's not He doesn't want to take big risks. He doesn't want to. If he thinks pessimistically. He's worried that maybe the investment might not be so successful. So he prefers to give half of the capital as a loan, and that way, half of the capital is more or less guaranteed. The agent will have to suffer the losses of that half. The disadvantage is that if the profit is successful, then he'll only be able to be entitled to half of the profits. With a standard Heta Iska, regular Heta Iska uses the Chatzim Milva Chatzim Bekodin, which means that the lender who now really becomes an investor, he's giving the capital to the borrower, he creates a partnership, the lender and the borrower are now partners in an investment, half belongs to the lender and half belongs to the borrower. To keep things simple, we'll refer to them as the lender and the borrower, although they are now an investor and an agent or a manager. There's three points to remember when we discuss the Chatzim Milva Chatzim Bekodin. These are the main points to remember to understand the Heta Iska. Is that firstly they're joint owners, so that all the profits have to be shared. Neither of them can get all the profits. Number two, because the lender has lent the half of the capital to the borrower, so now the borrower has to repay this loan whatever happens. That's the way the lender is secure on half of the capital. And thirdly, we have to remember is because it's a loan, the relationship between them is also partly loan, so the borrower has to treat the lender as a lender, and he cannot benefit him any more benefit than he's entitled to. Bearing this in mind, there's an obvious question that we have to ask here, which the Gemara already deals with, is that if there's a lender a borrower relationship in a Chatzim Milva Chatzim Bekodin, so why is the borrower, why is he prepared to work on the investment for free? We understand why he's prepared to invest on his work on his half of an investment, because that's where he gets his profits. But for the lender's half of the investment, why is he working on it? Why is he managing it? What's he getting out of it? So there's a reason, and this leads us on to stage two of the Heta Iska. This is, we have to make sure that the borrower gets paid a fee for doing his work. So the Rishos and Gemara are showing him how do we pay the borrower for doing the work, for finding the investment and for managing the investment. So what's the Gemara for Heta Iska is the Gemara says that if the lender arranges in advance how much he's going to pay the borrower, then it's enough to pay a minimal fee of a dinner. The machlokes in the achronim, how much is a if a dinner is dafka or lav dafka? So how much is a dinner worth? A dinner is not worth very much. A dinner is worth 192 protos. So whether it's dafka or lav dafka, it's not so much of a difference. 192 protos with the value of silver nowadays is probably just under a pound. In America, I don't think they're makbid on this dinner because they often write a dollar in the heta iska. But normally with a pound, at least nowadays, a pound will cover all shittas. But even if not, most poskim hold that a din is lav dafka, and even less a din is sufficient to pay for the schar tircha of the borrower.
I thought you said the fact that he's got the extra 50,000 means that he's got ability to. 100,000 loan is better than 50,000. So therefore, the investor, the borrower, the person who's going to do the actual investment for him, is going to generate far more profits,
but because
that might be his payment.
By his payment is basically the loan. He's entitled to it because he's borrowing this money. Any profits that result out of this capital is basically his. He's borrowed the money, so anything that comes out is his. It's not the lender's giving it to him. It's what he's entitled to. He has to get extra. He has to get something more than he's entitled to as his payment. And that's why we use this pandas hatecha. There is an alternative method of payment. This is more common. This is what most hatechas use. And this is, if we give the borrower, if the lender gives the borrower a share of his own profit. Until now, they're each entitled to 50% of the profit each. And now the lender may tell the borrower, I'll give you an extra 1%. Instead of me taking 50%, and you take 50%, I'll take 49%, and you take 51%. You get this extra percentage of the profit. The advantage of using this method is that we'll soon see that it may not have to be paid. But if someone uses the method of paying a pound, this has to be paid. The pound has to be paid to the borrower. These are the easy parts of the heta iska, the stage one and stage two, the creating the partnership and paying the borrower the schar tircha. The difficult part is stage three in heta iska. This is guaranteeing the lender his capital. How do we guarantee the lender his capital? And like we explained, an investment by definition has risks. How can an investor be guaranteed his capital? A lender be guaranteed his capital? So we could say, we can ask it as a shayla. Could we say that the lender can give the borrower the capital and say, I'm giving you the capital to invest, we'll share the profits, but on the capital, I want you to guarantee me the capital, I want you to pay it back to me. Would we be able to say that? So to answer this question, I just want to say over a shayla which Shaul Reisman had, one of the Kiyim and Ribbits in America. He had this shayla. There was a young man in America who heard of a property for sale. The property cost approximately $2 million, and he had information which meant that this property was going to go up significantly within the next year. So he didn't have the capital, but he had a friend who had a wealthy father. So he approached his friend, he explained to him the deal, and he asked him if he'll try and ask his father if he'll be willing to invest with him the $2 million, and they'll be partners, they'll share the profits, and he'll pay him back the capital. So the wealthy father agreed, but he said one condition, you have to guarantee me the capital. $2 million, you have to guarantee me. So they all agreed, they closed the deal, signed on the deal, and they bought the property. After a year, when it came time to selling the property, the younger man, he realized that he might have a ribbis issue at hand. So he called his Rav said he's not a bucky enough for ribbis, and he referred him to Rabbi Shaul Reisman. So Rabbi Shaul Reisman confirmed that there is a serious child of ribbis, and the younger man cannot pay any of the profits, which was $600,000 each. He cannot pay many of the profits. So Shali is what went wrong? Where was there any element of a havor? Where was there any loan that should have any problem of ribbis over here? So the answer is there's a fundamental difference between a loan and an investment. A loan is where a lender gives money to a borrower. He says, I'm giving you a loan. It doesn't make a difference to me what you do with the loan, but you have to repay me the loan. But you're successful with the money, you're not successful with the money, this money has to be repaid. That is what a loan is. An investment is totally different. An investment is when an investor gives capital to an agent or to a manager and he tells him, I'm giving you capital to invest. If it's successful, I'll expect you to repay me the capital with profits. If it's not successful, then I'll have to lose. So if an investor comes and he says, I want to invest money, but I want the terms to be like the terms of a loan, which means I'm giving you capital, but I'm wanting you to have to pay it to me whether the investment is successful or not. By setting down such terms, he's basically saying that I'm giving an investment but with terms of a loan. Chazal said when somebody gives an investment with terms of a loan, that investment is not an investment, it's a loan, it's considered a complete loan. So if it's a complete loan, then no profits can be paid. So too with this case in America, this wealthy man, he's stipulated with this younger man. He said, I'm giving you the capital to invest, but I want you to guarantee it to me. I want you to repay it to me, whether you're successful with the investment or not. This $2 million has to be repaid. By doing that, he's changing from an investment, he's changing it into a loan, and the loan may not be, and he's not entitled to any profits. The borrower will not be able to pay any profits. So this makes it more difficult. So how does a heter iska achieve this? How does a heter iska achieve that the lender can give money to invest, he can make an investment, and still be sure that he's going to receive back his capital with a profit? How does a heter iska achieve this? So the answer is that a heter iska cannot guarantee a capital. Heter iska makes it likely that the lender will receive his capital back. It cannot guarantee it. How does it make it likely? So for this, the Remender Ben Arvigda, who drafted the first Nusach, he came with an idea based on a Chumash Hadeshin. Shmuel Zotan writes in Simushin Beis that a lender who wants to give capital to a borrower to invest, he does not have to believe the borrower, if the borrower will tell him there are losses without any sufficient proof. The borrower has to provide sufficient proof. If so, so the lender can tell the borrower, I'm giving you the money to invest, but if you're going to claim there are any losses, then you're going to have to verify these claims with two extra kosher edim. Shmuel Zotan writes, not some two kosher edim, two edim, extra kosher, like the Rav and the Shatz of the town. It says the Shmuel Sadeshen that if a lender does do that, then he's Karav Levada, extremely, extremely unlikely that the borrower will be able to supply two kosher edim, two extra kosher edim, to prove that there were any losses, to verify that there were any losses. And if so, if you can't verify that there were losses, so by default, the borrower is going to have to reimburse the lender his capital. Remember Ben Avigdor and many other poskim, They took the idea, but they disagreed with the demanding two extra kosher edim. They said that for a lender to demand two extra kosher edim, like the robber of the town, the shliach tzibur, is too much. But what he can do is he can ask for two regular kosher edim. If the borrower can supply two kosher edim to verify that there were losses, then there'll be enough for a borrower to verify losses, and he won't have to pay the capital. Until then, if he can't do that, then he'll have to reimburse the lender's capital. This is the way a heter iska reimburses, guarantees, or almost guarantees, the lender his capital. But here, a lender has to also realize that there's an element of risk involved. If the borrower can indeed prove that there were losses, can indeed verify that there were losses with two kosher edim, then the lender won't be able to get his capital back. If there were losses, the lender won't be able to get his capital back. What also a lender has to know is, this is very nigea, is that if the lender himself knows that there were losses, then he can't demand that the borrower has to verify the losses. If he knows that there were losses, then no verification is necessary. All the facts are known. He knows that there were losses. So he cannot demand that the borrower verify losses, and if not, he has to reimburse him. This is very negative for family members who lend with each other with a heter iska, or business partners. This is very negative. Hashem, in next week, we'll discuss this more in detail. Possible solutions to resolve this problem for family members and business partners. This is stage 3 in a heter iska. Stage 4 in a heter iska is, this is guaranteeing the lender his fixed profit. How does a heter iska guarantee the lender a fixed profit? Like we said, an investment depends on the outcome of the investment. If it's successful, then he can be repaid as capital and profits. If it's not successful, then he can't be repaid, not the capital, not the profits. So how does a heter iska achieve that the lender will be repaid his capital with a profit? So the Shmuel Sadeshen doesn't bring down doesn't mention his idea of requiring aiding to verify losses. He doesn't bring this idea down for profits as well. Remember Ben Rav Vigda, he wanted to use the same idea for profits as well. Remember Ben Rav Vigda, he said that just like a lender can demand that the borrower verify losses to the capital with two witnesses, two edim, so too the lender can also demand or stipulate in advance with the borrower that whenever it comes time to share the profits, he's going to have to verify all profits with two edim as well. That's what Remender Ben Rav Vigda at first, this is what he wanted to use to be able to guarantee or almost guarantee the lender's profits. So Levush and Nisma, they strongly disagreed with Remender Ben Rav Vigda on this point. They said that to verify losses of capital, that's okay, that's acceptable, it's possible. Let's say, for example, if the investment was a property, So if there were losses to a capital, if it suffered damages, or if it got burnt, or something happened to it, so an investment, a property is in view for everybody to see. If there were losses to the capital, then it would be possible for two witnesses to testify that there were losses to the capital. But to require two witnesses, two edim, to verify profits, the Levush and the Smah, they both argue that it's almost impossible. How's two edim going to be able to testify, for example, that the tenant didn't manage to pay his rent, or how much the rent was? To be able to testify how much the profits were, that's much too difficult. So Smah says he wrote a letter to remember Ben Avigdor. He told him that Teshkog Yosmi Pe Hashalit, it's a mistake, it's much too much to demand that a borrower has to verify a profit with two edim. So remember Ben Avigdor, he conceded, he agreed, and he said that he'll change the nusach of the Iska, and instead of demanding that the borrower verify profits with two edim, he has to reduce the method of proof, and he reduced it to a shavua. A shavua is a much easier method of verifying profits, because it's totally in the borrower's totally in control. If he wants to make a shavua, he'll make a shavua. If he doesn't want to make a shavua, he won't make a shavua. The idea of requiring a shavua is two reasons. One is, often a borrower will not know exactly how much the profits were, so he won't be able to make a shavua. And secondly, another reason is, which is more of a common reason, is that the Torah and Shulchan Aruch write that it's very common to make a shavua, even a shavua be'emes. The Torah writes a lashon, "Ma'oid ma'oid yizari be'inyan ha'shavua." A person should be extremely cautious with the be'inyan ha'shavua. The Rabbi Singh, our Chazal, were extremely critical of anybody who makes a Shua Shekhe. But feel Yishava Be'emes, even to make a Shua Be'emes, K'moshe Omru, Elef Ayot Hoyoloi, Liana Yamele, Hoyoloi, Liana Melech, Vaya Melech, V'kulam Necheru Mecha Shua Emes. Yana Melech had 1,000 Ayoris in Har HaMelech, and they were all destroyed due to people not being cautioned even in the Shuras Emes. They made Shuras Emes whenever they wanted, and that caused those 1,000 Ayoris to be destroyed. So Mendel Ben Avigdor, he felt that this was enough to deter a borrower from making a Shuwa. It would be enough to frighten a borrower to make a Shuwa, and the borrower would prefer, instead of making a Shuwa, he would ask the lender to forgo on his right to a Shuwa, to be mevat on the Shuwa, and instead he'd pay him a fixed profit instead. We'll discuss shortly what this fixed profit is. So here too, this is more or less the idea of the way a lender, or heta iska, this secures, this more or less guarantees that the lender should be sure that he's going to get a profit. Because he's stipulated with the borrower that whenever he comes to tell him how much the profits were, he's stipulated with him that he's got to verify with the shavua. The borrower will either not know what the exact profits are, and he won't want to make a shavua. He won't be able to make a shavua, or he'll be too frightened to make a shavua, and even if there were no profits, he would rather pay the profit than make a shavua. So here too, a lender has to be aware that it's not guaranteed, that if there were indeed no profits, and the borrower is prepared to make a shavua, so then the borrower's full right to make a shavua. It's up to his own risk, but if he's prepared to make a shavua, then he's entitled to make a shavua, and if he makes a shavua that there are no profits, then the lender is not entitled to any profits. And here too, like we spoke about before, that if the lender himself knows that there are no profits, he has first-hand information that there are no profits, then there's no room for him to demand that the borrower either verify that the profits with a shavua, and if not, then he has to pay. That he's got no right to do so. The whole thing is a method of verification. If everything is clear, the lender himself knows that there were no profits, then he cannot ask him to verify this. That is stage 4 in Heta Iska. Stage 5 in Heta Iska, this is the setting the schumis bashus. This is the lender's rate, the profit rate of the lender. How do we calculate how much a lender can set down, can demand that the borrower either pay this rate or make a shavua, verify the profits with a shavua and pay the true profits? So what does chumis pashas mean? Chumis pashas is a lashon from pshara. It's a lashon of a compromise or settlement. The lender and the borrower they come to an agreement that the lender is willing to forgo on his shavua, on his right to a shavua, and in exchange for that the borrower will pay him a fixed fee. How much is that fixed fee? So the answer is, this seems to be the accepted mahalach. Rav Moshe Feinstein seems to learn it like that. Rav Yehuda brings it down from, so it's mashma like this from the Smah and Mechas Pitin. He says that the lender and the borrower, they sit down and they calculate, they estimate, how much can this investment How much profit can this investment generate? They anticipate, they estimate, and they anticipate how much profit can this investment generate? And then once they calculate it, they estimate it. So the let's say they invest in a property worth 100,000, and they estimate that this in property can generate a profit of 20%, 20,000 a year. So the lender can now tell the borrower, I have two options for you. I'm anticipating a return of 20%, £20,000 a year. I'll give you two choices. Either you make a shvua, which I'm entitled to ask for, because we've stipulated this in advance, we've agreed on this in advance. You're going to verify profits with a shvua. So either you make a shvua, and you verify the exact profits, and you pay me the true profits. Or if you want, I don't have to make any losses. I'm anticipating a return of 20%. You can pay me the 20% direct, and no questions asked. You pay me the 20%, and if there's any more, you keep the extra, and if there's less, then you'll have to add that from your own pocket and pay me this anticipated return. For a lender to demand that the borrower pay any more than the anticipated return, that is ribbis. He's got no right to ask for any more. He can only ask for what's anticipated. Any more than anticipated, that would be ribbis. He wouldn't be able to ask for that. This is stage 5 in Heta Iska. This is how a Heta Iska achieves that a lender can invest money with a borrower, and he can be guaranteed, almost guaranteed as capital, and almost guaranteed to a profit. This profit is usually that has to be the anticipated profit of what this investment can bring in.
Sorry, just to clarify, the bankers must invest. There's going to be a big loss, except a loss, and we'll get a capital back. The head is good.
They have to. Sense. This is what they're signing. They have.
That's what they do.
That's what they do. So in Esau,
if you can prove what he's made in the shvur, he can say there's a loss.
It's happened. It's been to course. There are big issues with it. Next week, I'll speak more in detail about it. But yeah, but on principle, that is what has to happen. They have to prepare to take the loss. So there is one more big color coming up, which the banks do rely on, which is what we'll see in a minute. But first, it's very important to remember that when calculating this sumis pashus, the anticipated profit, is that if the investment is a chatzi mil v'chatzi v'kodim, so really they're both partners, the lender and the borrower are partners, so the lender is only entitled to half of the profits. So if he estimates there's only going to be, let's say, 20% return on this investment, so then he's only entitled to 10% of it. So if he's only entitled to 10%, so he can only tell the borrower that either you pay me the 10% or you make a shvua and you verify the profits. He can't ask for 20% because he's not entitled to 20%. If you would want a higher profit, you would have to change the investment into a kula pekodin investment, and chatzi mil chatzi pekodin will not be enough. Yeah, you'd be able to do it. You can do any percentage. Yeah, but also there's the element of risk. However much profits he's going to have to take the risk equally as well. So there's an additional kula of the Chochmas Adam. There's a tremendous kula of the Chochmas Adam which the banks do use. Which is quite controversial. The Chofetz Chaim, he wrote a tremendous kula. He wrote that not only can a lender demand that the borrower verify all the losses of capital and profits with Edim or with a Shavua, but he can stipulate with a borrower that you're going to have to do this each month. Each month you're going to have to come and verify that if there were any losses or that you realize there's no profits, you're going to have to verify all of this at the end of each month, at the end of each chodesh. And if you don't come at the end of each month and make this declaration whether there were profits or whether there were losses or profits, then it's going to be considered hidas ba'din that there were no losses and that all the profits, anticipated profits, were realized. With this kula from the Chofetz Chaim, he's gained not much a tremendous kula. If for example, somebody had lent somebody with a Heta Iska, £100,000 with a schumus pashus with a rate of, let's say, 1% a month. So if at the end of the term, let's say it was for 5 years, if at the end of the term, before the kula of the Chochmas Adam, if the borrower would come at the end of 5 years and say that the capital's gone, the profits have gone, and he'd have aid him to verify it, and a shvur to verify that there were, and he'd be prepared to make a shvur to verify that there was no profits, he'd be fully entitled to do so, and the borrower would have to suffer all the losses. And this is what happened in Israel a few times. The banks had to suffer losses unless they went to court. But the bets then they would have to suffer the losses. But with this call of the Chochmas Adam, they've gained a tremendous gain. That if at the end of the five year period the borrower would come and say, I've got witnesses to verify the losses and I'm prepared to make sure to verify that there were no profits, the Chochmas Adam, it's too late. Where were you for each month? Each month he didn't come, there was Hadas Ba'din, that there were no losses and there were profits, and it's too late. There's no going back on your Hadas Ba'din. So this,
there is going to be a loss.
Could it be profitable? We have to
something. Yes, if it would be the last month, then you're right. Then the last month he would be able to make a shavua and verify the losses, and that if it all happened that month. But if it hadn't happened until that month, then he's ready to be asked by net, and there were no losses, and there was all the profits were realized, and he'd have to pay it. This is the Kulach of Sodom. So the Bris Yehuda, he was a dayan in the Badatz of Yerushalayim, and he incorporated this clause in a standard Hatayiska of one of the banks in Eretz Yisrael. Rav Moshe Steinbuch, he wrote a tshuva challenging this Kulach of Sodom and using it for the banks. One of his main arguments on this on the Bris Yehuda for using this Kulach for the banks. He says that the borrowers that come to the banks, they don't know anything about the Hatayiska. They just want to know the Hatayiska. They see it there. They don't read it. They didn't read the Kol of the Chochma Sodom. So they don't know the Chochma Sodom. How can we consider that the fact that they fail to appear to make this declaration? How can we consider that as Hadal Shvadin? They don't know that it exists at all. So he sent this tshuva to a few of the Gedolei Yisrael around Eretz Yisrael. He sent it to Rav Elzner and to Rav Nissim and to other Gedolim, and they all wrote back to him that they agree with him and it shouldn't be used in the banks. The Bris Yehuda, a few years later, somebody showed me the Bris Yehuda, and a few years later, when he printed his next sefer on Chesh Mishpat, in one of the notes, he mentions that he saw Reisi Mishim, the fact book, I saw that somebody challenged the Kol of the Chochmas Adam, and on me using it in the Het Eskos of the banks. He doesn't address the difficulties directly, but he does it. What is clear from his tshuva is that he says that he didn't retract his heta. He stayed with his heta that the banks should be using this Kol of Chochmas Adam. But what is clear from his tshuva is that it was all it's lahatzel from Isser Ribbis. It's all shas adchak. The banks need to be secure on the money. If they don't have the kulas as much as we can to protect the capital, then they're not going to be agreed to be using heta iskas. We have to do as much as we can to secure the money of the banks in order that they shouldn't make heavy losses. I spoke to one of the not in London, he told me that they don't use this Kol of Chochmas Adam. When it comes to big sum and big amounts, so then usually the lenders are not happy to rely on lending without the Kol of Chochmas Adam, and they will use the Kol of Chochmas Adam. One last thing I would like to finish off with is a Heta Iska Klali. What is a Heta Iska Klali? So a Heta Iska Klali is Just 100 years ago, is Rabbi Zvi Meir Eiger. He looked around in Europe, and he saw that people were lending people each other beribis without any heta iska. Beribis was rampant. It was all over, and he was horrified. So he came up with a proposal that each person should make a declaration, like with the Moshe Moedor, like we have with our Torah Zadorim. A person, he makes a declaration at the beginning of the year that any neder that he does in the following year should be is null and void. He doesn't really mean it, and it's all blined, and it's not laid at all. So Rabbi Zvi Meir Eiger, he came up with a proposal that a person should do that with ribbis as well. Whenever he gives money or accepts money, and it will involve any issur ribbis or violate any issur ribbis, then he's doing it all al pi hata iska. It's really what he means is investment. He doesn't mean any loan. So he didn't want to rely on his own opinion for this, and he sent this proposal all around Europe to all the Gedolei Yisrael. There were different opinions. Lekan, Rabbi Aaron Koller was against it. Rabbi Zalman Melzer was against it. But there were a lot of Rabbonim who agreed with it. But there were two points which not really realized, which even the ones who were agreed to rely on this Koller. What those 2 points are. The 2 points are, is firstly, it was all lahatzel me'isa v'shas adchak. Rabbi Zvi Meir Eiger himself writes that was all lahatzel me'isa v'shas adchak. It was a serious issurim going on, people just lending each other ribbis. And secondly, what people have to realize is that this is all when the lender and the borrower, they're both aware, and not both aware, they both have written this agreement. If the lender writes a Heta Iska Klali, he writes that any transaction that he does, which might appear as a loan, he doesn't want it to be a loan, he wants it to be an investment. And the borrower also does the same thing, then there's some kind of agreement between two people that the one's given money as a loan, he doesn't mean a loan, he means investment, and the person who takes it, also, when he takes it, doesn't intend to take it as a loan with ribbis, he intends to take it as investment, that's fine. But if only one person's done it, then most of the possibly, even the materium, they held that it's not valid. And the simple reason is that if somebody would lend somebody £500,000 for a year, and the person would come back after a year and give them a cheque of £250,000, The landlord will say, well, what's this 250,000? Where's my other 250,000? So you'd pull a paper out of his pocket and say, look, I've signed a hetesk kloli, or we point to a wall, I've signed an hetesk kloli. Whenever I take money from somebody, it's an investment, and we're partners in the investment. And if there's losses, then I'm very sorry. Then you lose your investment. So I took the money for an investment. I took the 500,000 to invest. I wasn't successful in the investment. So there was no profits. The capital's gone. Here's your share of the capital. Everybody would agree that it's a joke. Well, because I've got paper in my pocket, or I've got paper hanging on my wall. That doesn't bind anybody. That's not an agreement between two people. That's a one-sided agreement. That's not valid. So what is valid is what the Welt uses when they say hetesk kloli. It's not really hetesk kloli. What they mean is, when they have hetesk kloli and they make reference to it, when they have a loan document, when they draft a loan document, and they write that all transactions are subject to the terms and conditions of our hetesk kloli, of the business or of a specific one, that's fine. That's as good as writing a regular hetesk. But if you wouldn't write a hetesk, if you wouldn't make any reference to it, wouldn't make any reference to this Heta Iska, then it wouldn't most possibly be told that it's not worth anything. Just one more point, which is quite a common question, is does a Heta Iska have to be written down? Or can you just say Alpi Heta Iska? So the answer is that depends. If the loan was written down as a loan, it was drafted as a loan, and there's no clear evidence that it wasn't a loan, then it's also to just say Alpi Heta Iska. If there's a document which is a loan, then the Pesach writes and confines Zayin Sikot Vav, he writes clearly that a Heta Iska has to be written if there's a loan document. If there is no loan document, then strictly speaking, the Kutzer Shulchan Aruch writes that if the loan wasn't documented, then it's enough to say Alpi Heta Iska. L'chitzchila, a person should write it down, because then he knows what he's doing, and it makes it less aromatic. So just to summarize, what we've learned today is we've learned that a Heta Iska is no longer a loan. A Heta Iska is when a lender and a borrower, a lender gives capital to a borrower to invest, and usually it's a chatzim of a chatzim kodon. The lender gives a borrower capital, and he tells him half of the capital is for myself, half the capital is for you to invest for me. That's just the stage one, the Heta Iska, where the lender restructures the loan into investment. Stage two is that the borrower has to be paid for his work in the investment. He has to be paid, which we spoke about, either it's a dinner or a pound he can pay, or you can pay him a percentage of the profits. 1% would be enough. Stage number three is where we guarantee the lender capital. Remember when Avigdor came up with an idea that if the lender stipulates with the borrower that if he's going to claim that there are any losses, he's going to have to verify the losses to aid him. And here I just want to mention that now that we know that Shavua is a lower degree of a verification for capital, if a lender would prefer to use a Shavua instead of aid him to verify capital, that's absolutely fine. Stage four of a Heta Iska is guaranteeing the lender his profit, and that is remember when Avigdor, his maskana, he concluded with, is that the lender stipulates with the borrower that if he's going to, whenever he comes to share the profits, he's going to have to verify all profits with the shavua, and if not, he's going to have to pay. And at this we spoke out that he cannot use aidim, he will not be able to stipulate aidim to verify the profits. And stage number five in Heta Iska is setting the Stumas Pashas. The Stumas Pashas is the lender's rate of return. This rate of return we spoke out is the lender can stipulate with the borrower that I'm entitled to the estimated profit, to anticipated return. Either you pay with anticipated return, whatever it's going to be, or you make a sure and you verify the profit. As long as you don't want to make a sure, you don't want to verify the profit, then you have to pay me this anticipated return. Yeah.